Very tired.
No time to be tired. I'm going to have a sip of water, and then we're going to record a thing.
I'm looking forward to it.
The CMU podcast, in association with 7 Digital.
This week, IFPI stats, Facebook, We Shall Overcome, and NWA. It's the CMU podcast, chatting about the music business and that. I'm Andy Malt, editor of CMU. My guest this week is Chris Cook, the business editor of CMU. Hello, Chris.
Hello.
Have you done anything or been anywhere this week?
Have I done anything or been anywhere this week?
Because I haven't.
Well, by the time the podcast goes out, I will have been to the Music 4.5 event on playlists and playlisting and radio.
How was that?
Clashing with streaming, which is why we're recording the podcast a little bit earlier this week. So if anything major happens on Thursday, we won't be talking about it in this edition of the podcast, because on Thursday I'll be at the Music 4.5 event. But by the time you hear this, that will be in the past. It was brilliant, and my bit was I'm doing the intro, because most of the Music 4.5 events now, well, they're UK ones. They also do events in New York now, but they're UK events. I do a little story so far introduction, and so that is what I am doing. Did do, it was really good. So I went to I hung out with Rio Ferdinand.
You did, yeah, which is weird.
For about 4 minutes,
yeah.
Even though I didn't know who he was at the time, I weirdly ended up sharing a cab with Rio Ferdinand from King's Cross Station, Talyard.
Then you assumed that you were the most important person in the cab. Yeah. And just told him about streaming.
The cabbie clearly wanted Rio Ferdinand in his cab, because I was in the cab first, and then Rio Ferdinand rocked up, and clearly the cabbie wanted him in his cab, but I was in there first. But it turned out we were both going to the same place. So I was like, we'll just share. And the cabbie said, if you're okay with that.
So was the cabbie planning to kick you out?
I don't know. I don't know what would have happened.
I assumed that it was always set for you to share.
No, I was already in the cab when Rio Ferdinand rocked up. And then it turned out we were both going to the same place. So Rio Ferdinand got in. And the cabbie said, if you're okay to share. And I assumed he was saying that to me, as in you were here first. But in hindsight, he was presumably asking Rio Ferdinand if he was happy to share a cab. Rio Ferdinand then said to me, the cabbie then said, what's Talyard? And I said, there's lots of music companies there. I'm going to meet the Music Managers Forum. That's why I'm going to Talyard. And then Rio Ferdinand asked me about streaming. And then I talked about streaming for 6 minutes, like I do. And then we were there. Then when we got there, the cabbie asked to have his photograph taken with this guy who had got in the cab. And that was the point at which it occurred to me that perhaps this guy was quite famous if this cabbie wanted his photo taken with him. The conversation stirred towards sport, so I sort of had an idea he must be something to do with sport. And so then, once Rio Ferdinand had gone into the building, I then asked the cabbie, who the hell was that? And it was Rio Ferdinand. But I only vaguely know that he's a footballer. I wouldn't know what he looks like.
He's not a footballer anymore. Talks about football now.
Talks about football.
If you'd have let him speak, he might have talked about football.
Well, I'm glad I didn't.
You would have seen his skills.
Nothing bores me more than people joining Gary Lineker on BBC One to talk about football.
Talking about streaming is harder than talking about football. Talking about football is very easy.
So, yes, he was there, some digital agency doing something in sport. That's the only thing I got out. He got a lot from me.
That's the scoop.
That's all I got from him. And, yes, so then I knew who he was. But it has to be said, I often don't recognise pop stars if I happen to be in the same room as them. And I write about them every bloody day of the week. So I'm not going to recognise a footballer, bearing in mind I have zero interest in football. Although later the same day, after the MMF event, all the managers went to a pub to drink and I went with them. And Stephen Budd, who's the co-chair of the MMF, was there. And he was having a meeting with Romeo of the Magic Numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And the minute he walked in, I recognised him.
Well, he's very recognisable.
The minute, it's like, oh, that's Romeo from the Magic Numbers. I know him. I don't know Rio Ferdinand. So yeah, I've been hanging out with Rio Ferdinand this week. That happened this week.
Well, as you've clearly had some practice talking about streaming this week, shall we talk about it now?
Yeah, although the figures we're about to talk about hadn't been published at that point.
No, I realised that, but that was just a quick segue to get into it. And you have to derail it every time. Every time you derail my segues and this bit goes on for ages and people write in to complain.
And I just want it to be factually correct. I don't want anyone to think that I talked Rio Ferdinand through the IFPI global stats report, because then if they happen to share a cab with Rio Ferdinand, they might then question him on those stats, assuming I'd briefed him and I didn't. So Rio Ferdinand doesn't know anything about the International Federation of the Phonographic Industries global stats report for 2015. But you will do, because we're about to talk about it.
Yes, we are. The IFPI's Global Stats Report for 2015 was published this week.
Now, when we talked about the US record industry's figures...
Which we did.
2 or 3 weeks ago.
Yeah, or last week.
It wasn't last week. Was it last week? No, it was weeks ago. Because Matt was definitely producing, and Matt's been away for 2 editions,
yes,
seeing the world. He's back here today. The reason I remember that is because we talked about Matt putting a drum roll in because of the fact that the US record industry had seen growth in 2015.
Oh, yeah. Put the growth jingle in here.
Yeah. Big, big jingle because of growth. But if you thought that was exciting, wait till you hear the top level stat from the IFPI report. Because that, I can't even remember what that was, but it was tiny, tiny growth, wasn't it? It was point something.
I think that was 0.07, something like that.
So it wasn't even 0.1. You're
no,
right.
It was. Yeah, no, I remember. Yeah, we were way off 0.1.
So it wasn't quite 0.1. But hey, Andy Malt. Let's imagine the drum roll here. Hey, Matt's got a whole extra day to put together.
I'm sure there is one.
This podcast. So there may be a drum roll here. But if not, then imagine a drum roll as Andy Malt tells you how much the global record industry increased in 2015 in terms of revenue.
3.2%.
3.2.
Take that, US.
Percent. Yeah, America, letting down the side.
$15 billion.
America is the new Japan when it comes to...
Well, no, I'm not sure that's the case. $15 billion global revenues were in 2015.
So to recap, the record industry grew throughout the 90s with all those stupidly overpriced CDs they were selling, peaked in the very early 2000s, and then we had 10 years of steep decline, where every year the record industry was bringing in significantly less revenues than the previous year. For the last 5 years, it's been more or less flat. I think 2012 was a slight increase, but I mean, another one of those point something increases. Then we had another little bit of a wobble, mainly because of Japan. So although it is only 3.2% increase, it is quite significant because this is the first year of actual figures of growth rather than point figures of growth.
Actual growth that doesn't seem like a minor anomaly.
Yes, doesn't seem like probably a statistical error in the calculations of the figures. So yes, the record industry worldwide went back into growth in 2015. Although it's only relatively slight growth, as I think we did talk about when we talked about the American figures, these are revenue figures, remember. And digital is more profitable than physical. Not least because when they declare physical figures, so CD and vinyl sale figures, the record industry include the 8% that they immediately have to pay to the music publishers for the song copyright. Whereas with digital, with a couple of exceptions, in the main, the publishing bit isn't included in the figures that the record industry declares. So immediately, digital figures are 8% more profitable, give or take, than the physical figures. Plus, of course, putting out digital music is quite a lot cheaper than putting out CDs and vinyl and stuff like that. So although the revenue increase is 3.2%, the profit margins are also increasing. So that puts a slightly more positive spin on the increase in 2015. So break down for us how this $15 billion that the global record industry made in 2015 was split between the different revenue streams.
Well, digital now accounts for 45% of total revenue, which means that digital is now the biggest revenue source for the recorded music industry the world over. I mean, country by country, that's not always the case. But I think there was 19 countries where that is the case now.
Yeah, no, and indeed, because places like Japan and Germany, which are still, America is ahead of them, but two of the biggest recorded music markets in the world, and because they are still dominated to an extent by CDs, or in Japan's case, a lot by CDs, worldwide, this is the first year where the digital revenue stream is several percent points ahead of physical. So although in the US, the 50-50 point digital-physical passed a couple of years ago, in the UK, 1 or 2 years ago, we saw digital starting to outperform physical. Worldwide, 2015 was the first year. Although that is all of the digital revenue streams lumped together account for 45% of the market.
But that leaves 55%. Where's the rest going? 39% of it is physical sales.
And let's remember, we always say this, the vast majority of that 39% is CD sales. Don't be thinking that's the vinyl revival. Don't be thinking, oh, that's all vinyl. Just a little bit of that.
A very small amount of that
is vinyl. Most of that is CDs. CDs are still selling pretty well in a lot of markets, Japan and Germany in particular, but even here in the UK, about a third of the market, more than, is coming from CDs. So the CD is not yet dead, still accounting for about 39%, but here's some maths for you. 45 and 39 ain't 100.
No, it's not.
What's accounting for what's left, Andy Malt?
Well, there's a bit of sync and stuff, isn't there?
And public performance. So the money that comes in from radio and from recordings being played in clubs and bars and cafes. And actually, that's quite a big growth revenue stream. I mean, in the wide scheme of things, it's not massive. But let's not forget that the record industry is getting more money in from radio stations and from clubs and from the public performance of recordings, mainly because since the decline of CD sales 10 years ago, the record industry, who never really took public performance income, so in the UK, that's the money that comes in through PPL, the record industry never really took that very seriously. But in the last 10 years, they've started to take it seriously because they want every single penny they can get. And so that is quite a big growth revenue stream, which leaves sync as the smallest of the revenue streams. A little bit ahead of vinyl, I think. I can't remember the exact figures on
that. But still, I suppose sync and vinyl are the two things that everyone talks up as, oh, these are the things that are growing. It's all about sync. It's all about vinyl now. And they are the two smallest bits of
revenue. Tiny little slices of the pie at the end. And so within digital's 45% of the market, but that is all the different digital services, I suppose the big two being downloads versus streams. But the big trend of 2015, which we already knew this because it was basically the trend of 2014 as well, and we knew this from the country-by-country figures that were already out, we knew this by the figures that the major record companies put out four times a year. The big trend of 2015 was the shift within that digital chunk of money from money coming from the old download stores, basically iTunes, over to the streaming services.
Yeah. So, I mean, they're roughly, streaming and downloads are roughly bringing in the same. Streaming 2.9 billion and downloads 3 billion. The difference is that streaming revenue is up 45%, while download revenue is down 10.5%.
Yeah, and downloads were down more in 2015 than they were in 2014. So the decline of the download market is actually increasing. Although, as you say, they're still equal at the moment. Actually, downloads ever so slightly ahead. Again, as well as people often suggesting that sync and vinyl are the two big revenue streams, which they're not, the other sort of line you might have taken out of casual conversations about the record industry in 2015 is that downloads are dead, they're gone, and it's all about streaming. Well, certainly that's the trend, that downloads are going down, 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 and streaming is going up, 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 up. But don't write off downloads just yet. They are bringing in as much and slightly more last year. I mean, this year it will go the other way around. You know, for 2016, we will get more from streaming than downloads, but the download revenue stream is still there for the time being as a substantial chunk of the money that the record industry is making.
Yes, but as we said, the trend you're seeing is that streaming services are rapidly growing and becoming, as we discussed with the US figures, become an increasingly important part of the overall revenue share. The IFPI reckons that there are now 68 million users paying for streaming subscriptions now, which is up from 41 million in 2014 and about 8 million 5 years ago. So that's a rapid jump. That's going to a trend that we're going to continue, or we hope we're going to continue seeing, because now it's getting to the point where if that slows down, we're all in trouble.
Yeah, so I suppose with digital, you can split between downloads and streams, and then streams, you can split between the paid-for subscription services like Spotify Premium, Apple Music, Deezer, Tidal, and then the free services, so like YouTube, and in the US, services like Pandora, and I suppose the free levels of Spotify and Deezer. And the vast majority of that growth and that new money that's coming to the music industry is the paid-for services, those 68 million people who are paying to access music. So on the £10, €10, $10 package that is standard now in the streaming space versus the many, 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 many more people. I mean, Pandora alone has more free users than all of the paying users across all the different platforms. But actually, in terms of the streaming income, all the free services are bringing in a lot less money. So you're right. As streaming becomes the most significant digital revenue stream, and as digital becomes the most important revenue stream overall, and because it is Spotify, Apple Music type services that are driving all of that growth, let's remember, all of those services are not yet profitable. They're profitable for the record industry because they have all those minimum guarantees in place. So a Spotify and Apple Music have to keep paying into the record industry, however well they may be doing themselves. But the streaming services themselves are all still losing money. But everybody needs those services to become profitable long term, because if any of those, and I mean, of the services out there, we have to assume that the two that have the most assured future are Spotify and Apple Music. Apple Music doesn't really have to ever make big profits, because ultimately it's about selling devices. It's about giving Apple control without necessarily it being a particularly profitable revenue stream for them. But certainly Apple won't want to subsidize Apple Music for the foreseeable future. So it has to break even at the very least. For Spotify, it has to become a decently profitable business. And so everybody needs those services at some point in the forthcoming. I mean, how many years they can go, continue to lose money, I don't know. But once Spotify floats, which we now think is going to happen probably early next year, after that point, you'll have big investor pressure for this company to start becoming profitable, certainly year on year. And everyone needs that to happen, because if those companies go under, then that big growth revenue stream, which every year is going to account for a bigger and bigger chunk of the record industry, could disappear, and that would be a disaster.
Well, that's it. I think the disappearance of audio is not going to have a big effect on these figures for 2016. And the disappearance of Deezer would probably not have a significant effect.
If that were to happen.
However, if Spotify went, we would be screwed at this stage.
So, lots to be upbeat about in these figures, except for that proviso that of all the revenue streams, vinyl is up. But it's not huge. Public performance is up. It's actually quite a lot bigger than vinyl, but it's still not huge. The real growth is in subscription streaming, and these are in the main loss-making services. So there is a little bit to be pessimistic about. Although, actually, the IFPI was doing a very good job of being pessimistic, but not because of that.
No, they...
Not directly because of that.
They wanted to talk about the value gap.
The value gap, which they first talked about in a big way exactly a year ago when they put out the 2014 figures. And it always has been that whenever the IFPI put out the global figures or the BPI put out the UK figures, ever since the rise of the web and of digital, it's always been, oh, last year was really good for all of these reasons. And in more recent years, genuine reasons why last year was good, because we started to see some growth. But there's always something at the bottom of the press release that says, but it could all be so much better if only. And it used to be that the if only was, if only we could stop piracy, if only we could stop file sharing, if only we could overcome all of that. But as of 2015, the gripe at the bottom of the press release started to become safe harbours and the value gap, which is really code for YouTube and very much the theme of the IFPI statement around the figures this year. To the extent that not only did they have the customary safe harbours gripe at the bottom of the press release, that was the headline of the press release. Yeah. They elevated it to the top. Bearing in mind that this is the record industry returning to growth for the first time in like over 15 years. But rather than having a big party type headline, it was this growth should be a lot bigger and it ain't because of safe harbours, because of YouTube. Hey, Mr. Lawmaker. Hey, Congress in Washington. Hey, European Commission in Brussels. Fix this, was basically what they were saying.
Yeah, it's not going to fix anything, and it's—I mean, even if it happened, which it won't.
Well, that's that's a nice little.
The lawmakers aren't going to change safe harbour law, and even if they did, it would not change anything so sharp.
If you don't know what safe harbours are and the value gap are, where have you been?
We've talked about this a lot.
But if you read the write-up of the report in the CMU Daily, which obviously you can get at completemusicupdate.com, we do a quick recap of the whole safe harbour gripes. And also, I embellish slightly on Andy's bold statement there that the music industry ain't going to get its way on safe harbours. And even if they do, that's not the real problem. There are other things that the music industry at large, not necessarily the trade bodies, who are lobbying organisations, who probably are right to focus on problems with the law, but the more commercial side of the industry, there's other things that everybody could be doing, labels, publishers, artists, songwriters, to try and push streaming into the next chapter where the services start to become profitable, and this could be the record industry actually turning a corner. It's never going to go back to the 1990s heyday of the record industry, which was always fueled by CDs being £5 more expensive than they were ever intended to be. So I don't think you're ever going to get back to that. But lots of reasons to be positive. The record industry is in growth. they don't need the revenues of the 90s because digital is more profitable, bigger profit margins. Plus, of course, while the record industry went into steep decline in the 2000s, the music industry at large, live boomed, merch boomed, brand partnerships boomed. So the music industry at large is still doing as well as it ever did. It's the record industry that saw the decline. So I think we will see continued growth in the record industry, and that is great. Although, if the IFPI's definition of success is getting back to where the 90s were, if we're going to carry on banging on about the value gap until the record industry is back in revenue terms to where it was in the 90s, we're going to be talking about the value gap for a very long time.
Cheer up, dickheads!
Yeah. What a conclusion. So there you go. That is our summary of the IFPI 2015 Global Stats Report. I will make sure a copy of this is forwarded to Rio Ferdinand. I'm sure he would love to know what we think.
Hey, so you know how YouTube is the devil and needs to be sorted out?
Yeah, I do.
Well, what about Facebook?
What about Facebook?
Because Facebook's all about video now, isn't it?
It is.
All about user-uploaded video.
When you open up your Facebook app, there it is. All of those videos.
And you load it up, and there's a video there, and it plays automatically, and you go, that's interesting. I'm sure that video is from somewhere else that has not been cited here. And that's the problem, isn't it?
It is a problem. So Facebook is moving very much into video, and video is becoming a bigger part of the Facebook offering. Content creators are being encouraged to upload video into Facebook, and lots of media and actually lots of labels and artists are now putting video up on Facebook. It's interesting to compare what artists and labels are doing with video on Facebook versus video on YouTube. But you're also starting to see on Facebook, just like on YouTube, random punters are uploading videos that they don't own, they don't control, into their Facebook profiles so that they get the likes, they get the views, they get the engagement, but it ain't their content. And of course, technically, that is copyright infringement.
Yes.
Basically, this slightly waffly introduction to this story is our attempt to hide the fact that this is another Safe Harbour story.
Well, I think also this hasn't been talked about so much in the music industry, and that's partly because, in a cruel twist of fate, it's actually the YouTube creators who are generally having their content ripped off and put on Facebook. So it's them who've been complaining about it.
Yes, you're right. So you could say video has been quite a big deal on Facebook for a while now. More and more video content is being pumped up there. So why haven't the artists and the record companies, who are very good at dissing YouTube, we know that because we read the IFPI press release. They never mention YouTube by name, but we know what they're talking about. Why haven't they been moaning about Facebook as much? Because there is plenty of music content up on Facebook. But I think that's because video on Facebook just arrives in your feed. Whereas obviously with YouTube, there's a much more of an on-demand element to YouTube.
Yeah.
You go to YouTube and you say, I want to have a whatever video, and it comes up and you watch it. So in that respect, YouTube has many more parallels to a Spotify or an Apple Music in that it is, in essence, an on-demand streaming service. Whereas because Facebook doesn't quite have that functionality yet, it may well be added down the line, I think the labels still see Facebook much more as a promo platform, which they used to think of YouTube. Mm. You know, back in the days when YouTube was the one bit of Google that the labels didn't moan about, it was because it was like, oh, YouTube's promo. We love YouTube, it's free promo. And it's in more recent years, it's been, oh, hang on a second, YouTube's also a streaming service competing with Spotify on much more favourable terms. Whereas the labels, I think, still see videos on Facebook much more as promotions. So they're not so worried about the fact that their content is getting uploaded there. They're not earning royalties. They don't necessarily have the control over that content. So as you say, ironically, it's the kids who have their successful YouTube channels who make their living out of the advertising and sponsorship on those YouTube channels who don't like the fact that random people are nabbing their content and sharing it on Facebook. So they have been calling, and the MCNs, as they're called, who represent YouTube talent, have been putting a lot of pressure on Facebook of late to basically set up a system like YouTube's Content ID that allows rights owners to come into the back end of the platform to log the content they own and then to control the distribution of that content across the network by third parties who don't actually control the copyright. And we knew Facebook had been developing a version of YouTube's Content ID for a while now, but this was the week that they actually unveiled the system that they are presenting to rights owners of the world.
Yes, it's called Rights Manager.
Why not?
They've unveiled it. That's it. It's basically Content ID allows you to block unapproved uploads of your content, and then you can whitelist certain pages and profiles so that they can upload your content. And what did they say? They said you can specify permitted uses of each video by setting match rules, which sounds like a lot of fun. The one thing it doesn't have, which Content ID does have, is monetization.
Yeah, as much as we all hate YouTube, apparently, at least YouTube put monetization into the system. So obviously with Content ID on YouTube, you go into the system and you say, I own these recordings, I own these songs. If anybody else uploads those recordings or uploads those songs and your system spots it, there's a bit of an if there, if your system spots it, but let's assume that it does, then either block the content and don't let the content be uploaded, or you have the monetization option, which is let the content go up on somebody else's YouTube channel because perhaps they've got an audience, perhaps that will get views, but stick a load of advertising around the video, stick a pre-roll in, little banners within the video, and I, the record company, will take the money, the 55% that YouTube pays to the rights owners for that content. And that is what is missing from Facebook Rights Manager as of now, although this is very much a work in progress. It's been in progress for a while now. They're now opening it up to more rights owners. You have to apply for access to it. It isn't just there if you have a video channel within your Facebook profiles. You have to apply to use it. But I think it is very much early days. I know Facebook are experimenting with the monetization of video on its platform and sharing that money with rights owners. So I would assume that monetization will come to Rights Manager down the line. But for the time being, that is a major weakness in terms of what Facebook are offering rights owners versus what YouTube offer rights owners.
Yes, so we will see how that develops in the coming months.
And whether or not it placates those whining YouTube creators who are annoyed with their content being ripped off by Facebookers. But it will also be interesting to see as the monetization elements are added, which I assume they will be, and as video just becomes ever more substantial and significant on Facebook, is how the music industry responds to it, both in keeping their content off the platform, but once there is monetization in there, in treating Facebook, like YouTube, as a revenue stream, and presumably at that point, moaning about Facebook's royalties and exactly like YouTube's royalties, because ultimately Facebook, we will be relying on the same safe harbours as YouTube in order to try and get more favourable deals. So there's swings and roundabouts there. Facebook is going to become a revenue stream for the music industry, and that's exciting, although Facebook have just as much interest as YouTube in keeping the safe harbour protection that gives them more favourable terms, which means you now have both Facebook and Google.
So that gives an even more... I mean, Google on its own is a powerful lobby compared to the music industry, and Google and Facebook. Those safe harbour laws are never changing.
This is where Andy Malt's pessimism is coming from. Never I'm an optimist. It's all going to be fine. You're going to get what you want. And yeah, the future is golden. Or the future's blue. Because Facebook is where you're going to be making all your money in the future. Does that not work? You look angry at my...
not angry.
...summarization there. Disappointed. Anyway.
No, it's fine. Facebook. The future is blue. No, I was just thinking, that, what about Google?
What about Google? Well, what? Google's multicoloured.
The future is multicoloured.
The future is whatever colour.
But with a particular emphasis on blue because Facebook's in there as well and there's blue in the goo. I mean, it's not as snappy as what you said, but it's more accurate.
It is more accurate, but you were moaning when I was trying to be accurate earlier. Anyway, to conclude, Facebook announced a load of stuff this week, including Rights Manager. CMU approved time now on the CMU podcast when Andy Malt recommends some music that you might wish to listen to.
You might.
You might want to listen to Fake.
I would say Fake Ear, but it's one of those things I don't know. I've never had to say it out loud before, and I've never heard anyone say it out loud before. So who knows? It could be Fuck Ear.
I don't think it is.
Could be. It's French, and that sounded a bit French.
Maybe. Tell us about their track, Shere Khan.
His track, Shere Khan, is a new single from his upcoming debut album, Animal, which is out on the 10th of June. Fake Ear is someone who I have enjoyed the music of for a few years now. I think he started releasing in 2013.
Yeah.
And I've never actually approved him before. So
finally got round to it.
Probably should.
With his dense, warm electronic music.
That is exactly what it is. This track is apparently inspired by the tiger from the Jungle Book, who is called Shere Khan.
I think everyone knows that.
I don't know how it is influenced by that, but that's what he said.
And who are we to question his inspiration in creating this track? Dalek comes next.
Dalek! You got it wrong.
You should know that because they've been around for like 20 years.
Yeah, they have been around a very long time.
They've got a new track out called Control. It's the second single off their new album, Asphalt for Eden, which is out on the 22nd of April. And it's their first album after a bit of hiatus.
Yeah.
They last released an album, Gutter Tactics, which was also very good, in 2009. And then producer Octopus moved to Berlin. MC Dialek went and I think he did a degree or something, like a PhD maybe. Anyway, he's back. Octopus isn't.
I'm going to say they're not both back.
They're not both back. Octopus is off in Berlin doing other stuff. But apparently this reunion had his blessing, so it's all fine.
It's all fine.
There's no bad blood. So he's back building, and it's a welcome return, which is a phrase I think I say far too often now I think about it. One of the things I read this week referenced Dialek in terms of preempting death grips, which I don't think is entirely fair, but I can see where they're coming from, because they do create this kind of dark, claustrophobic hip-hop. It's a very kind of specific sound, sort of built on drones, and yeah, it's very dark. It's good.
Dark. Claustrophobic hip hop.
Yeah.
Who's next? Slow Wolf.
Yeah, Slow Wolf and Kimbra.
Yeah.
A match made in heaven. Slow Wolf.
Says Andy Malt of CMU.
Yes. Slow Wolf is someone I've approved before because he's good. He's a Danish hip hop, because he's kind of is influenced by hip hop and R&B, stuff like that. He used to have like kind of, when I first saw him, he was making kind of hip hop with like death metal guitars. That's not the case anymore. It's a bit more. Not mainstream, but, you know. He's working with Kimbra now, who is definitely pop. And their two sounds work together very well. In fact, I would hope that they would do more together. And certainly their quotes about each other in the press release for this suggested that they got on very well.
And they're
big fans of each other's work and very happy with the results. So hopefully there will be more from them.
But Whole album.
Maybe. But right now you've got White Feathers, which is the new single.
Anchor Song is our final CMU approved of the week.
Anchor Song released his second album, Ceremonial, in January. This is the second single from it, Expo. It comes out later this month, but you can see a video of him performing it live at the Red Bull Studios in Tokyo right now. It's a sample-based sound.
You
can watch it right now. But it's him doing this track on a sampler live. But it's his influences are vast and stretched back through musical history. His sort of aim is to bring together traditional and modern music, is what he said, which is sort of quite vague. But it's basically taking influences from kind of like old Western soundtracks and traditional Japanese music and old kind of rock music, and then putting it into sample-based music, but keeping the warmth of the music he's influenced by, which he does very successfully. The album's very good. This track is a very good introduction to it, so go and listen to it. You can hear it either by going to completemusicupdate.com/approved and finding the relevant articles, or you can go to that on Spotify. There's a CMU-approved playlist which doesn't have all these tracks in because Dialek haven't bothered, but you can listen to the others.
So go and check out the write-ups on the website, and then from any of the write-ups, you can click through to the Spotify playlist and listen to these approved tracks, asterisks, not all of them, but tracks that have been approved since the start of the year.
Most of the tracks since the start of the year are on that playlist, which has not always been the case with new music on Spotify and streaming services in general. It's very much changing.
Yeah. Artists and labels are getting their content up on Spotify quicker, whereas it used to be that it would sit on SoundCloud for a couple of months before it got onto the proper streaming services. Is that a slight at SoundCloud? Anyway, completemusicupdate.com/approved.
Hey, you know how we like a good copyright lawsuit?
I do.
Well, how about two?
Two of them.
I've got two for you this
week. That's a little bit extravagant. I hope the budget can run to two copyright lawsuits.
Well, we'll see. The first one, I'm sure everyone remembers the Happy Birthday to You case, which we covered on the podcast a while back, when it was ruled that, in fact, Warner Chappell in the US did not own it. It was public domain. And in Europe, it's all a bit confusing. Well, the law firm behind that is basically bringing an identical case over We Shall Overcome. I mean, it's identical in the fact that the Happy Birthday to You case was a documentary film was being made about Happy Birthday to You. They then didn't feel that they needed to license it from Warner Chappell to have it in the film because they thought it was public domain. And then they went legal over it. This case is a documentary film company is making a film about We Shall Overcome and doesn't think it should have to pay to license We Shall Overcome because they think it's public domain.
Well, actually, there was also the allegation that the publisher who thinks they control this piece of music wouldn't let them license it, let alone them not thinking they should have to pay anything anyway.
It is slightly more complicated than the Happy Birthday
case.
It
is, although it's interesting because it is very much the sequel to the Happy Birthday case. And the Happy Birthday case was rumbling through the courts for quite some time. A very interesting outcome to the Happy Birthday case. And if you remember when we talked about it, it was a complicated case because there was a number of different allegations. And in the end, the judge only ruled on one of the allegations, but that was enough for Warner Chappell to then do an out-of-court settlement where they basically gave up control of the Happy Birthday song in the US. This is very much a sequel, and it's interesting because normally when you have sequels to big lawsuits, it's because there is an appeal to the original ruling, and therefore it all goes back through the courts again. But this is very much a sequel, but with a different piece of music, a very famous protest song, and also complications, but in some ways slightly different complications than the original case.
Yeah, so in this case, whereas before, you know, it was Warner Chappell being targeted, they're the big guys, everyone knows who they are. This is some smaller companies, Richmond Organisation and Ludlow Music, who are being told off.
And also, I suppose, with the Happy Birthday case, it was generally accepted that the two sisters who had originally done a publishing deal with the publisher that Warner Chappell then acquired, it was generally agreed that in the late 19th century, those two sisters did write Good Morning to You, which was the song that morphed into Happy Birthday.
Yeah.
So there was agreement that they had originally written the original song. The question then was, when was the original song written? And more importantly, when were the Happy Birthday lyrics added to the song?
Yes.
And then you add in all the complications about copyright terms for works that were created in the early part of the 20th century, which is a much more complicated system in the US than it is here in Europe. And so when were those lyrics written? Who wrote them? Was the copyright and the lyrics ever assigned by the sisters over to the publishing company? When were the copyrights registered? Because there's copyright registration in the US. But it all began with an agreement that the original song was written by these sisters. Whereas with this case, a core allegation is that this song began as what they're calling a spiritual. So basically, it's a song of which nobody really knows where it came from.
No, and in fact, there was, I mean, the lawsuit sort of dates it back to 1909, like the We Shall Overcome adaptation of it. However, there was an article in, I think, The Atlantic last year, possibly, where they traced it way back, like into the 1800s.
So this is a song, that, like a classic folk song, in essence, that just no one quite knows where it came from. No one quite knows who wrote it. And so, therefore, that is slightly different, that basically the song just goes way back into history. So nobody can really claim to have written the original song. However, there have been some reworks and adaptations of the songs over its history. And it's one of those adaptations that was copyrighted and which is ultimately now controlled and owned by these two smaller publishing companies. And so that the question is, an adaptation of this song was put down on paper, and the publisher who controlled that work registered it in the US. What were they registering? And therefore, what song, what music, what composition do they actually control here today in 2016?
Yeah, so although there are various points you can trace this song back to, and the earliest point the lawsuit traces back to is 1909, it's all tied in with folk singer Pete Seeger, who is particularly linked to the song at various points in its life in the kind of the modern age. Sort of starts in the mid-40s. He used to publish a regular book of songs, and We Shall Overcome was included in one of these books in 1946 and credited then to the FTA CIO Workers Highlander students.
Whatever that means.
That's the thing.
There were then some releases of the song.
Yes, particularly Vanguard Records in 1959 included a recording of it on a Charlton Heston narrated album called Out of Africa, The Moses Story. And then Cherry Lane Music in 1960 registered the copyright based on that recording. Then also in 1960, Ludlow registered another version of the work, which it credited to someone. And it went back and there were things that said that the song was originally called I'll Overcome and it had been changed. It all gets a bit fudged. And that's where the lawsuit is aiming for.
Then a few years later, Pete Seeger released his most famous recording of the song. And I suppose, crucially, he chose to get permission from Ludlow in order to release this record, they having registered their version of the song 3 years earlier. But what is now being said in this latest litigation is that what was registered in 1960 was a very specific version of the song, which had an extra bit of composition, I think a couple of extra verses added. But the basic song, the one that Pete Seeger himself had published in the 1940s, which we're dating all the way back into the 19th century, that wasn't what Ludlow were registering. That isn't what Ludlow therefore own. And actually, we don't even know if the original version of the song ever qualified for copyright, if it was ever properly registered. But if it was, it would have been linked to the publication in the 1940s, the Pete Seeger publication. And because of the complicated changes to copyright terms in the early part of the 20th century in the US, if we're locking that version of the song, the sort of the famous version of the song, back to the 1940s, well, that copyright would have expired. So I suppose, like one of the elements of the Happy Birthday case, as I said, the Happy Birthday case were a number of different elements to the dispute, but one of the elements was very similar to this in saying that what the publisher being sued owns is a very specific interpretation of the song, but they don't own the generic song. And that was actually one of the allegations made against Happy Birthday, yeah, albeit not the bit that actually then got judged on in court. And in essence, that's what they're saying here. OK, you, Ludlow, might control this very specific adaptation of the song, but the original song you never had and is out of copyright.
Yeah, and so what's also interesting about this case is various interviews with Pete Seeger are included in the lawsuit, in which he basically says the song was sort of, it became an anthem for the civil rights movement, and the folk scene were concerned that the song was going to be taken and turned into some cheesy pop song, and they wanted to stop that. So that's why Ludlow registered it, in order to then control it so they could deny anyone from making a cheesy pop song out of it.
So that they had good motives.
So they had good motives, but the lawsuit is arguing that they didn't actually have any right to the song at that stage.
And therefore, crucially, they no longer have any control over the song come 2016. And so what this litigation is seeking, like the Happy Birthday litigation, is a declaration that Ludlow only control a very specific version of the song, and the song at large is public domain and anyone can do whatever they like with it. They can put it into their documentary without having to get a license from the publisher. They can make that cheesy pop song version if they so wish, because the publisher only controls a very specific version of the song. And stage two of the litigation is anybody who was forced to pay the publisher to license this song in the last however many years should get their money back, which is actually what is happening with Happy Birthday. We're still not quite sure how that is working, but as part of the out-of-court settlement, Warner Chappell is putting a chunk of money aside for people who have licensed Happy Birthday in the US over the last, God knows what, 20, 30, 40 years to get some money back, because Happy Birthday is not in copyright. And the same would be attempted if the court ruled that this song is not in copyright either.
I promised you two copyright lawsuits.
You did. If your head is spinning because of that. Actually, the one we're about to come on to is a simpler, straight plagiarism case. It isn't one of those, like the Happy Birthday case, like this new case, where there's lots of different strands and it's all very complicated and it's all down to technicalities of American copyright law. The second one is much easier to get your head around.
This is very simple. Led Zeppelin stole the opening chords of Stairway to Heaven. Very simple.
And who did they steal it from?
They stole it from a band called Spirit.
And what song did they steal it from?
It was called Taurus. It was an instrumental.
Do you want to apply some allegedlys into these statements?
No, no. Oh, all right, allegedly. All allegedly.
So actually, this isn't a new case.
No, this case has been going on for a while. And the accusation is basically that Led Zeppelin, before they were big, so in the late 60s, they toured with this band Spirit, supporting them. This band Spirit had an instrumental track called Taurus. 1971, a few years later, Stairway to Heaven comes out, and it's remarkably similar according to this lawsuit. But as we say, this case has been going on for a little while now. What's changed is that last week a judge ruled that a jury might find that there are similarities, and therefore this case has to go to jury trial.
Yes, so Led Zeppelin are fighting this litigation. They've been saying, what are you talking about? There's no plagiarism here.
Ridiculous, Jimmy Page said it was.
So they were wanting a summary judgment, basically for the judge to throw it out of court. And actually, in the ruling the judge made, He didn't seem that convinced that there was plagiarism here, but he did say that the claimant's arguments were sufficiently strong that this should go before a jury so that they can decide whether or not there is sufficient similarities between the songs. Just like the Blurred Lines copyright case of last year, there was then a bit of discussion. The defence was saying, well, what you're saying is similar is just a common chord progression that is found in all sorts of music. So that whole thing of, if you have common elements of rock music and they're found in multiple songs, surely that can't be copyright infringement. So that will be part of this debate. But as I say, although the judge said that he didn't think they were significantly similar, the case was strong enough that it should have a proper hearing, it should go before a jury. And I think we should be getting it in court around about May time, I think they were saying. So this is a case that's been rumbling through the courts for a couple of years now, and we could actually see it going before a jury this side of the summer. Which means, just like the Blurred Lines case of last year, we will have unqualified jurists listening to musicologists, those weird experts that only...
In fact, the musicologist who was supposed to be testifying for Justin Bieber and Usher in the case we mentioned last week, where through some complications they'd lost their expert witness, was working on this case. That was why that happened.
Yeah, if you remember, Bieber is fighting a plagiarism case. They missed an important deadline to submit their expert testimony. Yeah, and as you say, the reason they missed their deadline is that their expert, who was meant to be providing the testimony, is the expert in this case, I think, for the claimant's side, not for Led Zeppelin's side, but I could be wrong. Anyway, more musicologists in court spouting nonsense. Another jury, just like in the Blurred Lines case, then have to randomly decide. These two songs are clearly similar. Are they sufficiently similar that it is copyright infringement? But the development in the last 7 days is that a jury will get to decide on this, and we could have a resolution this year and maybe as soon as May. So that's something to look forward to.
Just time to run through a few of the stories we've not had time to talk about in depth this week. There's some new European collective licensing regulation.
Yes, the European Union's Collective Rights Management Directive that was passed 2 years ago has finally become law!
Hooray!
That's exciting.
Bruce Springsteen and Bryan Adams both cancelled US shows in protest against new state laws, two different state laws seen as anti-gay.
Yes.
For various different reasons.
So in America, because same-sex marriage is becoming the norm rolling out across the entirety of the US, certain states that aren't happy with that are now introducing these new laws, often referred to as religious freedom laws, which are, I guess, they've been generally seen as being anti the gay community. They clearly are.
Yes.
The gay community. They have been quite controversial. And yeah, and to the extent that Bruce Springsteen and Bryan Adams have both
issued statements. Bruce Springsteen's one was the transgender law. Basically, you can only use a public toilet based on your birth gender rather than what gender you assigned. It's like, it's so clearly like anti transgender people. It's also pointless.
laws about which toilet you use. So Bruce Springsteen has spoken, Bryan Adams has spoken, and they've both pulled out of these gigs. And Bruce Springsteen has a lot of sway in the US. You know, when Bruce Springsteen speaks, often things happen. So good on him for taking a stand, and let's hope that that pressure...
Well, it's also Netflix is threatening to, because they've got offices. It's North Carolina, that one. Netflix are threatening to move their offices elsewhere.
So let's see what happens there. But no Bruce Springsteen gig, no Bryan Adams gig in those states.
Nigel Adams, MP, has proposed a new bill banning people from carrying and setting off fireworks in the audiences of live music events, which seems madness. That's not a law already, but it's not. It's illegal at football games, but it's not illegal at music events.
Yeah, as it currently stands, if you go to a festival, you're allowed to set off fireworks, providing you aren't deliberately trying to hurt people.
Even if someone gets hurt.
Even if someone gets horrifically hurt. And so he wants to make that a criminal offence, just like it is at football matches. So there was a prison sentence. And also, with the football one, you can be banned from your local football team stadium for a substantial period of time.
6 years.
So there might be something similar on that side too. But it's a private members something or other. I can't remember the exact terminology. It's not government legislation, so it probably won't go through.
No.
But don't take fireworks to the
festivals.
Who would think that was a good idea?
Sticking with festivals, Heavy Fest has not only cancelled this year's event, but just decided not to do it ever again.
So this is a rock, heavy rock festival.
Yep. You could call it that, even though it makes you sound very old. It's one of those noisy ones.
But they had to move sites, didn't they?
Yes. And there's some building work going on at the site. It was a Port Lymph Wildlife Park in Kent. They'd used for 5 years.
They were going to move it into the Midlands somewhere.
Yeah, up in Derbyshire. But now they decided not to bother.
Not to bother. So it was a popular little festival. So it's a shame that they are no longer continuing.
Gareth Gates, what's he up to? He's launching some tea.
This has been a very popular story online.
Coconut tea.
So Gareth Gates, the original pop idol loser in the in the UK, is back with tea.
Yes.
And you were sort of in your write-up of this story describing Gareth Gates as an innovator in using his name and his brand and making money selling tea.
Was I?
But he's basically ripping off Mr. Scruff, isn't he? There is precedent of musicians.
Mr. Scruff made actual tea. Gareth Gates, his quote did make it sound like he was just like, I've just been mixing up bits of coconut in my kitchen. I can't believe people want to buy it now. He's selling it like it's expensive, £4.20 for 15 bags.
So if you fancy drinking coconut tea, whatever that is,
just mix it up yourself.
Gareth Gates is your man.
He's already said that, you know, you can mix it up in your kitchen. There's no need to pay him money.
So our Gareth Gates and finally story. I'm doing a segue here, but you normally do the, to read more about these stories, go to thecompletemusicupdate.com/podcast.
Yeah, do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Gareth Gates and finally story, people seem to like, they were tweeting about that. But the other and finally stories you've been writing this week have proven to be controversial.
Yeah, yeah. I've received a lot of angry emails this week.
Amongst the fans of Kiss. Yeah. The band, not the radio station.
Yeah. I mean, if you're going to annoy someone, you might as well be the fans of Kiss.
So this relates to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, who inducted some new members last weekend.
Yeah, the weekend. Yes. Including NWA. Much to the displeasure of Gene Simmons.
So Gene Simmons actually gave an interview to Rolling Stone.
Yeah.
This is a while back, a couple of weeks back, or maybe even longer ago, but talking about the fact that NWA, sort of the legendary hip-hop act, were being inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
And deservingly so.
He took great offence at that on the basis that they do not fit his definition of rock and roll.
No, which is just daft. But he said, Gene Simmons is a man who can give a daft quote when he wants to, and he did here. He said he was looking forward to the death of rap, which he predicted would come within the next decade. I'm not sure why he thinks that's the case, because it clearly isn't. Also, of all the things to complain about, like, oh, this music has been around for more than 30 years and is now clearly established enough that it's getting inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, it's probably going to die soon.
Well, it seems to be what he was saying was that he thinks, you know, guitar-driven rock music is going to have another moment in the spotlight, going to become mainstream again.
Which has happened like five times during the history of hip-hop.
And then
and hip-hop didn't die.
His conclusion being that will kill off all rap music, all hip-hop, and the future is rock.
I mean, grunge happened in that time.
It did. Britpop happened in that time. Green Day happened in that
time. Emo.
Kings of Leon. New metal. There have been a lot of guitar-led revivals.
Well, new metal and hip-hop
exactly.
Being flipped in with it. So that's, it's letting the side down, isn't it?
So this interview actually happened a few weeks ago, but NWA, when they were being inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, referenced back to the fact that Gene wasn't impressed with their induction.
Yeah, and I think generally, I mean, like when Jay-Z headlines Glastonbury, when Kanye headlines Glastonbury, there's always people coming out going, oh, I can't believe they're letting hip-hop be a thing. And so I think there probably had been other people questioning NWA getting into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, even though clearly they deserve to be there. But Ice Cube, in his acceptance speech, said, rock and roll is not an instrument. Rock and roll is not even a style of music. Rock and roll is a spirit. It's a spirit, and it's been going since the blues, jazz, bebop, soul, R&B, rock and roll, which is a thing that we're talking about anyway, heavy metal, punk rock, and yes, hip hop.
I actually think with that quote that he delivered when accepting it, he shouldn't have included rock and roll in that. Because obviously by rock and roll in that list, he means sort of the 50s, 60s era rock and roll. But then that sort of confuses his point, because he is saying, okay, there is a genre of music that is rock and roll from a period of history and time. But actually, the concept of rock and roll is just innovative, groundbreaking, genre-breaking, interesting musicians. It doesn't matter whether or not you play guitar or you play synths or you rap or you sing. It's a spirit rather than a genre.
Yeah, I would say it's a spirit of rebellion. And so early rock and roll fits in with that, and early jazz and early hip-hop all fits in with that spirit of rebellion and new things and people trying to change things.
Yeah, that's good. So therefore, the rock and roll genre, once it became more established and mainstream, actually ceased to be rock and roll, even though it was rock and roll. And I think that what this tells us is that terminology like this is just generally nonsense.
It's just pointless.
And there's no point trying to get all pernickety about the precise definitions, because they're all just loose terms that can mean whatever you want them to mean.
Yes, but Gene Simmons, never want to let anyone else have the last word, tweeted, "Let me know when Jimi Hendrix gets into the Hip Hop Hall of Fame, then you'll have a point."
So this was responding to Ice Cube's speech at the induction.
I don't know that that entirely fits anything. I mean, there isn't a Hip Hop Hall of Fame, for one thing. I mean, someone is trying to launch one, but there currently is not one, so that would make it hard for Jimi Hendrix to get in there. Also, it turns out Jimi Hendrix played on like a proto-hip-hop record in the late 60s, so his place in the Hip-Hop Hall of Fame would be well-deserved.
Yeah, so when they launch it,
he should definitely be in there.
Should be in the Hip-Hop Hall of Fame, as it turns out, none of which has any impact on whether or not NWA should be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, because clearly they should be. So shut up, Gene Simmons, is the conclusion of this. Or actually, Gene Simmons, talk nonsense because that's amusing. Shut up, Gene Simmons fans.
Yeah, just don't email me about a headline you've misunderstood. Also, if you're going to get annoyed about a headline, read the story that goes with it, and then, you know, maybe your questions will be answered and you won't have to send me long emails about how Gene Simmons has definitely heard of Jimi Hendrix. Obviously he has.
So anyway, Gene Simmons versus NWA versus the definitions of words this week. But I think we can all agree that NWA belong in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I mean, it's if you look at people who've been inducted over the years, I mean, lots of pop acts have been. It's not like it has been really narrowly defined as guitar-driven rock music are the only people who get inducted into that museum in Nashville.
People do like to get upset about things, though, don't they?
They do. They do. But hey, it got Gene Simmons lots of press, and that was probably what he was going for. So we've just fallen foul of his plan to keep people like us talking about Kiss. But there you go.
Yes, although someone did accuse me of self-promotion.
Did they?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, well, there you go.
well, but why don't you do some self-promotion to wrap up this podcast?
All right, let's wrap it up. Hey, so do you think that rock and roll is entirely defined by the use of guitars? Then stop fucking emailing me. My question for this week.
Yes, good question.
If you're not a Kiss fan, please subscribe to this podcast and tell all your friends about it. And if you are a Kiss fan, please stop emailing me. This podcast was presented by me, Andy Mort, who you should really stop emailing if you're a Kiss fan, and Chris Cook. Don't email him either. It was produced by Matt Petey, who also should not be emailed. And if you want to read more self-promotion from me, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, the CMU podcast is an Unlimited production in association with 7 Digital.
You're going to sneeze?
No.
Plus, there are a lot less costs. Did you want to burp?
Just trying to get a burp out there.
Okay.
Just doing finished. It quietly. You carry on without me.
Have you finished?
I'm fine now.
Okay. What did I just say? Where am I going?
I don't know. I was busy burping.